If you like stories about clever and reasonably attractive orphans, suspicious spires, carnivorous leeches, Italian food, and secret organizations, then stay. As I retrace each and every one of the Baudelaire children's woeful steps. My name is Lemony Snicket, and it is my sad duty to document this tale.
That is how the movie and the first book of Lemony Snicket's series of unfortunate events begins. But like an off-key violin concert, the Roman Empire, or food poisoning, all things must come to an end. Or so warns the dust jacket of the 13th and final volume of the Chronicles of the Baudelaire Orphans. It's due out on October 13th, and if it's anything like the preceding 12 volumes, it will shoot immediately to the top of the children's bestseller list. Anne Strangehemp sat down recently with a man responsible for Lemony Snicket, writer Daniel Handler. He told her, as you might expect, that he never intended to write the awful books in the first place.
Yes, it was an editor's suggestion and then persistence. She had read my first novel, The Basic Eight, which is not for young people necessarily, but is about young people. And so the editor asked me if I might be interested in writing something for young people. And I said no. I just thought it was a terrible idea. I thought the sort of stories that occurred to me would be nothing that anyone would ever publish for children. And she kept asking me, and then despite myself, I began to have this idea. But it was a dreadful idea. It was about three orphans and a count who would never leave them alone. And I thought the only thing more interesting than one miserable story would be 13 miserable stories in sequence. And so I called the editor and arranged to meet her in a bar because I thought, well, I'll tell her my idea and she'll tell me it's dreadful. And then at least it won't be too awkward because we'll just be in a bar and we'll finish our drinks and go home. And she said she liked the idea, which only embarrassed me further because I thought it meant she was a lightweight.
or drunk.
well, precisely. And so I thought, now it's going to be even more embarrassing because the next morning she's going to give me a call and say, I don't know what I was thinking. It was the whiskey sidecars. But instead she called me and said, I still like the idea and I'm stone cold sober sitting at my desk.
One of the things that's so distinctive and immediately enticing about the stories is the way they all begin. With the narrator telling you that you couldn't possibly want to read this story, that this will be a dreadful experience and you'd much better put it down and go find something else to read. It sounds like that really came out of your real feelings about the books.
Oh, it absolutely did. I mean, what looks like a sort of shrewd marketing plan now based on reverse psychology was quite upfront. Particularly on the backs of all the books is a letter from Mr. Snicket explaining why you shouldn't read them. And it was only when I was done with The Bad Beginning. And the editor said, well, you need to come up with something. I thought you might enjoy coming up with the cover copy, something to write on the back to get people to buy it. And I thought, I have no idea what could possibly lure people other than people who know me personally and want me to succeed. That was the only thing the only angle I could think of. And I took a walk to think about it and went grocery shopping. And when I stopped in one of the pharmaceutical aisles and saw all of the warning labels on poisonous substances, that's when it occurred to me. And I remember that I wrote the first one and I sent it to my editor and I thought, I kept thinking that I was always reaching the threshold of the moment where they would say, you're right, this is a terrible idea. And I was sure she would call me and say, well, thanks for taking a crack at it. That's all wrong. And instead she said, this is great. And I just kept waiting for that moment to arrive when someone would tell me that the gig was up. I thought my editor was crazy. And then I thought, the sort of editorial board that decided to actually publish the books was crazy.
I don't know what the moral in that is, but there's got to be one. Well,
that the world's gone mad. I'm the primary symptom of it.
13 bestsellers later.
I would say that the books just failed to fail. I was sure that they would fail, and they didn't.
Well, one of the best decisions you made was surely to make the Baudelaire children orphans. I mean, I remember talking with a children's book editor once, and I asked her if children's book editors had kind of an ideal platonic book in their mind that would be the perfect book to sell. And she said, yes, we call it Little Orphan Pony in the Storm.
Absolutely.
What is it about orphans, do you think?
Well, I think there's a number of attractive things about orphans that all go hand in hand. I mean, there's the essential existential fantasy of childhood, the first time you grab your mother's hand in a supermarket, and it turns out to be the hand of some other mother, hopefully still attached to the body of the mother, and that you have this terrible moment where you're all alone and you begin to think of other circumstances in which you could be alone or a greater length of time in which you're alone. And I think that's just a natural fear. But also from the writer end of it, from the author end, it's so convenient to have the parents out of the way, because if you want children to be the heroes of the story, they have to sort of be unsupervised. There's no such thing as a supervised hero. And there are a number of ways in which children's literature does that. They can have the father, you know, need to go off woodcutting all the time, leaving the children alone with the stepmother, or the parents can be too busy and sort of have a latchkey kid experience. But a really easy way is just to kill them off at the beginning.
Children, I'm afraid I must inform you of an extremely unfortunate event. I'm very, very sorry to tell you this, but your parents have perished in a fire that's destroyed your entire home.
If you have ever lost someone very important to you, then you already know how it feels. And if you haven't, you cannot possibly imagine it.
Where do you think your own taste for melodrama and for gothic elements comes from? I mean, how far back can you trace that into your childhood?
I was exposed to opera at a very early age. I was a boy soprano when I was very young, and I was taken to the opera at a very young age. My father was a supernumerary in the opera. My parents actually met at a performance of an opera. I mean, many people have said to me, well, the operatic plots are all well and good for the opera when the music is so melodramatic, but you put them into things that don't have any music at all. But I just always thought that was more interesting.
It is true. It's sort of the exact opposite of the kind of stories we think are appropriate for children. I mean, in an opera, usually, at the beginning, everybody's fine, and by the end, they're all dead.
Yes. It's wonderful. I mean, in an opera, a marriage will crumble and a woman will throw herself down the stairs. You just can't get that kind of entertainment at home, hopefully.
I guess I was wondering whether your books also partly grow out of or are fueled by a kind of dislike of some of the books, at least, that children
are
given.
I hope so. They certainly sprung from a dislike of children's books. I mean, I think one of the germs of my idea about the Baudelaires was that someone had suggested that I write for children, and I thought, oh, I know exactly the sort of crummy children's book you want from me. It's exactly the kind of crummy children's book I was given all the time. It was exactly the kind of crummy children's book that made me throw books across the room.
Like what?
Well, I don't wish to name any
names.
Johnny Tremaine, which I always hated.
But what makes a children's book crummy?
I think the fact that a hero is rewarded because of the goodness of his or her deeds, and a villain is punished because of the badness of them. The moral that if you behave well, you'll be rewarded. That just doesn't happen in life. And I'm not only talking about the great injustices we can all rattle off, but just by the time you're in kindergarten, you've already seen what some kid will get away with and never be punished for, and how, you know, an adult can come into a room and assess completely incorrectly whatever tiny drama is happening and assess blame and punishment. And you begin to see immediately that whether you're rewarded or punished is a chaotic process that has to do with luck and manipulation and circumstances.
Where did you develop and when did you learn that, in fact, I mean, that different moral sensibility, that good things don't happen to good people? I mean, I read somewhere that your father was a Holocaust, had escaped from the Holocaust. Was that something that permeated your childhood and partly helped develop your own moral vision?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the stories around the family dinner table were often about who got out of Germany in time and who didn't. And certainly how that worked was all a matter of luck and circumstance. It was not because some people were good and kept quiet and minded their table manners that they managed to escape. It was because the Nazis forgot to look under the sofa and didn't think to check the haystack, and that the money turned out to be enough to bribe the right person.
Hmm.
So I think that had the shape of it. And I actually think a Jewish upbringing always has the shape of chance and misfortune, even if you're not hearing stories about your own relatives. You're given the sense that the Jewish people are people who survived just sort of by the skin of their teeth all of the time.
And then there's the humor lacing through it all, too. Because isn't the humor the sort of, I mean, that's the only way to deal with the fact, don't you think, that life is constructed of so many accidents and so many weird, strange chances, and the only way to deal with it is to have a sense of humor about it.
Yes. I mean, there's even schools of rabbinical thought that think that a sense of humor is a holy state, and that's why there's so much misfortune, is that God doesn't want to be overly revered. He'd rather sort of be winked at.
We haven't talked at all about your authorial alter ego, Lemony Snicket. You do something that's sort of like your fiction in some ways. When you do your bookstore appearances, you go in the character of Daniel Handler, the handler of Lemony Snicket. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. Lemony Snicket never quite makes it. And so I'm forced to stutter unconvincing lies in his stead about where he is and about why I'm there instead.
Do people usually understand what you're doing and that you really did write the books? Or do some people get confused?
Some people get confused, but what's sort of depressing is children are used to exactly that kind of stuttering, incoherent dishonesty from an adult standing in front of them in a suit. And they're so used to that. It's not clear whether they believe me or not, but they're up for that kind of challenge. They're up for trying to discern what's actually going on behind what the adult is telling them. Mm. It's fascinating to me.
Now that you've finished, well, have you actually finished, written the last word of the last book?
I have indeed. It is locked up with the illustrator who is just finishing the last few pencil marks on the illustrations, and then it will be locked up until October.
And will you miss Lemony Snicket?
I feel confident that Mr. Snicket will return. I don't like to make too many promises. Given the chaos we've been talking about, I could be run over by the proverbial bus tomorrow, and then nothing more would happen. But I suspect Mr. Snicket will find other things to be interested in.
Glad to hear it.
Me too. Certain people have said that the world is like a calm pond, and that any time a person does even the smallest thing, it is as if a stone is dropped into the pond, spreading circles of ripples further and further out until the entire world has been changed by one tiny action. If this is true, then the book you are reading now is the perfect thing to drop into a pond. The ripples will spread across the surface of the pond, and the world will change for the better, with one less dreadful story to people read, and one more secret hidden at the bottom of a pond where most people never think of looking. The miserable tale of the Baudelaire orphans will be safe in the pond's murky depths, and you will be happier not to read the grim story I have written, but instead to gaze at the rippling scum that rises to the top of the world.
Daniel Handler, reading from Volume 12 of A Series of Unfortunate Events, which he wrote under the name of Lemony Snicket. The 13th and final installment of the series is due out on October 13th.